Good afternoon and welcome everybody to the first official event of the Migration Policy Institute Europe. I'm very excited to see so many familiar faces, and while this is of course the first official event of MPI Europe, MPI has been working in Europe for a number of years, whether with member states, with the various EU institutions, or with EU presidencies over the last decade. But with MPI Europe, MPI is establishing a permanent office here to offer evidence-based policy analysis, both at national and at EU level, I think at a critical moment in Europe's future. And today's meeting draws from one of MPI's flagship initiatives, MPI and MPI Europe's flagship initiatives, which is called the Transatlantic Council on Migration. This brings together senior politicians, policymakers, and experts to discuss critical issues that are salient on both sides of the Atlantic. At our last plenary meeting, held in Berlin in November last year, we focused on one of the most salient yet sensitive topics in the area of migration, the issue of identity in Europe. This sits at the crossroads of a number of key issues right now, whether it be the future of integration models and the dreaded word multiculturalism, whether it be about Europe's economic insecurity and concerns about the future prosperity of Europe, whether this is about the political changes and the increased support for far-right groups in some but not all member states, and some of the critical questions of how can we do better at integration and how can we think about our European identity in a rapidly changing world. I would draw your eyes to this council statement, which is beautifully printed out, which highlights some of the key findings from that meeting. We're here to discuss some of the deeper issues. We've managed to gather together, I think, a quite interesting panel. Cecilia Malmström from the European Commission, who has a deep interest in integration, and indeed we had the publication of the most recent agenda on integration in the middle of last year. Charles Clarke, former UK Home Secretary, who has deep interest from both an educational point of view, but from his time as Home Secretary, in how integration and cultural practices can be governed within particular countries. Patrick Simon, who many of you will know, a director of research for the Institut National des Etudes Demographiques, and I'm sorry for my French accent, it gets worse and worse, who has been doing some fascinating research looking at the identity of immigrants and self-identification of immigrants. And last and definitely least, the president of MPI in MPI Europe, Dimitri Papadimitriou, who will speak a little about our work over the last few months with respect to the Transatlantic Council on Migration. So I would like to welcome you all to some short remarks from each of our panelists, and then what I hope will be a lively discussion. And I know there are a number of you in the audience who have lively opinions. So with that, I would like to hand over to Commissioner Malmström.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. I'm really sorry for coming late. I was in the European Parliament in the committee, and I was defending a proposal that had nothing to do with migration, but it was on transatlantic issues, and it's very controversial, so I couldn't go before the last question. Thank you for your patience. And thank you for inviting me to this, and congratulations for having a little sister here in Europe now. I'm looking very much forward to that, and I think they will improve even more the cooperation that we have with you and that you will have with the European University in Florence. Now, this debate is, of course, very complex and difficult. Identities. When I was little and I got the first books in school, I signed my name, I said Cecilia Malmström, and then I said my street and the municipal where I lived, and then it said Gothenburg, West Sweden, Sweden, Scandinavia, Europe, the globe, Milky Way, universe. Maybe you did the same. So that was all I could figure out. I think that already showed many identities are possible, and they're not really mutually exclusive. So you can have several identities at the same time. Possibly now as a grown-up they're a little bit more thought through than when I was seven. But I think they increasingly more people do have many identities. And of course you can add political identity or religious identity or the very strong identity coming from your local football team or whatever. And all that goes very much into one person, and it's not a conflict. And the whole idea of the European Union is, of course, to cover all these identities, that coexistence of plural identities is possible, it's desirable, it's the whole idea of the European Union. number of nations, plurinational states, each of them with their own culture, identity, history, language, national character. And the best of all of it is that in Europe we are all minorities. Now, to be honest, not many of our citizens, especially today, identify themselves as Europeans. And that is confirmed by statistics from Eurostat and so on. But maybe, thinking about it, many would, even if they don't label themselves as Europeans, they would convey to what we call European values, the values that the European Union defends. And I don't mean that they're only European, they're of course also American, but the freedom, the tolerance, the openness, fundamental rights, the very values that we have created our European Union project on. Now this today is being questioned. The narrative on migration, the narrative of rejecting migration and open border is also rejecting in many ways the narrative of Europe, the idea of openness, open borders, tolerance, multicultural. And that's why many of the political parties that we see now emerging, becoming stronger. In fact, never since the Second World War in Europe has there been so many anti-migrant parties represented in national parliaments. And they, if you look very briefly, they have not only an anti-immigration agenda, they also have very often an anti-European agenda. Now, we should not reject the challenges related to migration. As political leaders, as policymakers, researchers, or all of you in one way or another that relate to this, now, migrants, of course, are a great asset to Europe. They have built our societies, they have enriched them culturally, socially, economically, politically, and we are facing a huge demographic challenge, so we will need more migrants in the future. And our role is to facilitate migration, but we should not reject or denounce the challenges related to migration. And I have read all these reports, and I think that is sort of consensus emerging from that. Now, the anti-migrant parties, they're only one part, but there are skeptical voices in our society, and we should take their concerns very seriously, because integration, migration is not an easy thing, and we can see in many of our suburbs that integration has failed. There are differences when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to social life, when it comes to language skills and results in school and so on. So we must admit the problems, the challenges and the failures, but not adopt the solutions presented by these populist parties. So migration is a possibility. It's something that we need to remain competitive. Imagine that all people of non-Europe went on strike for one day in Europe. I think the social services, for instance, in Spain would not work at all, because they're mainly built on people from Latin America. We also know that only in the couple, 2-3 years, we will need about 2 million health workers additionally in Europe, and they're not to be found within Europe. And we can have statistics on that. So a positive attitude towards diversity is, of course, key when we talk about integration. If people feel welcome, if people feel that this is a country where you have possibilities, where you're welcome, where we want you, that is a key to integration. Then learning the language, getting a job, a home, access to services, etc., are of course extremely important as well. The respect of universal values and fundamental rights, not only the right not to be discriminated and to be accepted, but also your duty as a newcomer to respect those values are important. So migrants must be informed about their rights and obligations, and must be given the instruments to be acquainted with these values. Another important is how migrants can contribute, can participate in their new societies, in the democratic process. In my view, civic participation and facilitating empowerment of third country nationals is something that fosters a sense of belonging. So acquiring citizenship and getting the possibility to vote and to serve your new country is, of course, something that is important to integration. These issues lay very much with the with the member states or even locally. They set the rules for citizenship, the possibility to vote, the access to the anti-discrimination laws. Well, they are European, but there are also national possibilities and encouragement to work, language, etc. is not something we should sit here in Brussels and do. But it's still the main message of the European agenda for integration that you mentioned, Elizabeth, in the beginning, that access to job, access to language skill, the issue of feeling welcome and open, but also a shared responsibility. Integration is about two parts of contributing to your new country, is key for integration. What we can do in Europe, on a Brussels level, is of course not to integrate people, but we can exchange viewpoints, we can fund projects, we can coordinate, we can facilitate, we can spread good practices and bad practices as well, and we can learn a lot from international experience. I was in a similar debate and a panel 2 weeks ago with the US ambassador, was it, Bill Tenard, and he said, well, we don't have integration policies in the US, and we are spending hours and hours in Europe to discuss how we can be better, improve our integration policies. So, well, we don't have policy for integration. We have a job and languages, and then the society sort of takes care of that in a different way. So I think we can learn a lot from US and from Canada, but also recognizing that Europe is different. So this is a challenge, a true challenge. We must not reject it. We must not be foolish or naive. There are true challenges, but we should also acknowledge that migration is here to come. Migration has been good for Europe. It will be good in the future, and we need to deal with those problems. It is totally possible to have many identities. That is not the problem. The problem is living them out and setting a framework where this is possible without discrimination and where everybody has equal chances when it comes to language and when it comes to jobs. So these were a few introductory remarks. I saw that many of these thoughts are also in the publications there, so I imagine you have a possibility to come back to this morning.
Thank you very much, and I can confirm that I used to say I was from the north side of the Milky Way when I was 7.
Oh, you had one more.
I would like to hand over to Charles Clark from the UK to offer some thoughts from his side.
Well, Liz, thank you very much for the introduction, and I firstly want to congratulate MPI, the Migration Policy Institute, of whose Transatlantic Council I'm a member, on establishing this very firm and solid base in Europe. I've been a member for almost a year, and I've been extremely impressed by the quality of the work done by MPI, the quality of the research work that you commissioned, Dimitri, the quality of the seminars and events that you have, the types of people involved, is really at the absolutely top level of discussion on these issues. And as I've been campaigning for a long time to try and get a much more serious discussion about migration, particularly in the European context, but actually more widely, I think the addition of your quality to a generally good level of debate in Brussels in any case is extremely to be welcomed. So I really do congratulate you. And at the risk of appearing very sycophantic, I'd also like to congratulate you, Cecilia, because I think as Commissioner, you've really tried to get this issue on the agenda in a very, very serious way. One or two of your predecessors, though not all of your predecessors, have done this, but you're almost alone amongst the Interior Ministers and Education Ministers of the whole of the European Union in really wanting to give attention to this issue and push it up the agenda. And one of the reasons I'm delighted to be here myself is not only to agree with what you just said in your remarks just now, but also to give whatever support I can to your efforts to push this issue right up the agenda and to get it properly considered. I very much agreed with your overall approach. My Bible in this is a book called Identity and Violence by Amartya Sen, in which essentially he argues that every individual is a set of different identities. So I can be, as I was yesterday, a Norwich City supporter, angry at Manchester United for scoring the winning goal in the last second, a Caucasian, a Londoner, a former Member of Parliament, a Labour politician, somebody who's very interested in mathematics, etc., etc., etc. And everybody, actually everybody in this room, everybody in the world, is this combination of different identities. And it's my choice to decide which of these identities to elevate at any given time. So I may decide to be a Norwich City supporter above all other aspects of my life for an hour and a half yesterday afternoon, or I can be a former Labour politician or whatever. But the point is, it's my choice. Nobody has the right to put me in a box and say, you're just like that, and that's how you are. And when you get to the more serious identities about gender, about faith, and so on, it's really important that people are entitled to express themselves in the way that they choose, and not to be defined by somebody else as being a black or a Paki or whatever it might happen to be, and only defined in that way. And I think his book, which I really would recommend to anybody, is a statement of the kind of liberal value which you set out, Cecilia, a second ago in what you were saying. I do agree with you that the issue of how to make this a living way of organising our societies and how we address integration in these questions is very much one for local communities, and it's very difficult for the European Union, other than the ways you described, to say here is the model which works equally well in Athens as it does in Leeds, as it does in Gothenburg, or whatever. Because the fact is, these great cities and these great cultures are all very different in the way they operate. If you try and put an absolute way of doing it on it, it simply won't work. But the area where I do think that that work at the European level is very important is in the governance of migration. You were right to raise the approach of the anti-migration political parties that have grown up. I spoke about this first in 2005 in the European Parliament when the UK was president of the council at that point, and I was Home Secretary. And I said, if at the end of the day the EU cannot get hold of these issues like migration, or a range of other issues actually in the justice and home affairs area, like serious and organised crime, like counter-terrorism, people will at best say, well, what's the point of the EU if it can't address these issues which are of concern to us? And at worst say, as many anti-migrant parties do, the EU is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that's why there's often a correlation between what they're saying about issues like migration and an anti-EU feeling, which isn't only important as expressed by that party itself, but also in the corrosive effect on the conduct of politics more generally in the countries concerned. I know I'm speaking particularly from the UK perspective, where we've certainly seen it in spades, probably more than in any other country. But I believe in other countries too, it's a real issue. And so you've got to have the courage, as Cecilia just did, to say, actually, we have to talk about this question. We can't just brush it under the carpet, in particular the centre-left in politics, has thought we could somehow brush it under the carpet. Well, we can't. People are concerned about it. They may be concerned about it irrationally. They may be concerned on the basis of totally false propaganda. They may be concerned about it because of a perception in some newspaper they've read which actually doesn't bear any rational relation to reality. But there are concerns. And my point, and I think I'm with you on this, Cecilia, is that we have therefore to address it. I remain deeply optimistic. I believe that the concerns that people have aren't in general fundamentally racist or fundamentally all inward-comers or whatever, though there are issues, there's small groups for whom what I've just said isn't true. But what they want to see is a system of migration in which they can have confidence, where the rules of governance of the migration system are solid and work properly and are seen to be transparent and are seen to be just and fair, so that they're not unfairnesses that arise in the system. And too often, they look at the migration system and believe it's, in their phrase, out of control, that there isn't a governance system that operates. That's certainly been the problem in the UK, including the period when I was Home Secretary, and I think it's a problem in certain other countries as well. So people believe that there is not, in fact, an effective system of governance of the rules of migration that exists. And my appeal is to develop such a system of governance. Many efforts, in fact preceding Cecilia as well as of Cecilia's, to try and achieve such a system of governance have not been able to get support from the member states in the way that it's necessary to do. And so the political situation, Cecilia, which you find yourself in, is very difficult. You make a proposal, but then other countries say, well, actually, we're not going to deal with that for whatever reason, whatever reason, whatever reason, and so nothing happens. I wrote this pamphlet, which was launched in Brussels here with Antonio Vitorino in January, and it was published by the Centre for European Reform just before Christmas, saying what I thought were the key points. And just to summarise very quickly what they are. Firstly, I think there needs to be a clear set of rules across the EU for who is entitled to migrate into the EU or not. At the moment, people migrate for one of four basic reasons: to work, to study, to family reunify, and to seek asylum. Those are the core reasons. There are also other reasons, but those are the main ones. Work, it's clear there isn't a united single European labour market, and therefore you can't really talk about a single set of rules for people coming to work across the EU. There are different countries and subsidiarity has to work, but you do need a system where people know what happens, and I say the same is true for students. When you talk about family reunification, it's one of the most pernicious areas where some of the nastiest and most horrible propaganda is put around, for example, by the Geert Wilders Party in Holland. Really very unpleasant and often extremely inaccurate and wrong. But there are very wide variations of practice across the EU. And I think there really is a case for getting to a much more coherent position across the EU about what the criteria for migration for family reunification are. And then, of course, the big one, asylum. The EU has been trying for a long period of time, there are many commitments, including at heads of state and government level, to get a common asylum policy of some kind. How do you implement it? What do you do? How does it work? That builds up some of the biggest feelings of concern, the biggest worries about governance and migration. Certainly in the UK's case, it was one of the most difficult issues to get hold of. But we need clear criteria in these areas. Now, as I say, I don't believe the Commission can be faulted on this. I think it's been putting forward for a number of years and intensified, really, under your leadership, Cecilia, efforts to try and get some agreement in these areas. But too many member states say, actually, we don't need to handle that. We can just let it go. And I don't think that's correct. I think unless there is clarity about these situations, it's got to be resolved. The second core issue is the establishment of a firm external border. The establishment of the agency, which has really worked very well to try and secure the border. You yourself went down to the Greek-Turkish border to try and help the efforts that were taking place there. They're constant issues. The Arab Spring has created great issues. But the central question is you have to have good relations with your neighbour countries. And the big issue that is the case, as Ilka has set out, is if you can get a proper agreement between the EU and its neighbour, whether in Western Africa or in North Africa, or between Greece and Turkey, very difficult to achieve, then you can get to a situation where you can operate a better system of control. And of course, the neighbouring countries to the EU are themselves victims of this as well. The overwhelming majority of people coming from those neighbouring countries into the EU are not citizens, or they don't come from those neighbouring countries themselves. Those countries are themselves a transition zone from beyond those countries in, and they have a very strong interest for solid and good cooperation in those areas. And I would also say that that illustrates the need for a really coordinated effort between the European foreign policy aspects of what happens and the European interior ministers and home affairs aspects of what happens. Quite difficult to achieve. I know a number of you in the room are foreign affairs specialists. I think it's quite difficult to get foreign affairs people to take migration very seriously. I certainly did find it difficult when I was in government, though we had a good relationship with our foreign office. But actually saying, in our relations, I don't know, with Algeria, with Libya, with Tunisia, or with Turkey, or whatever, we've got to put the foreign policy issues side by side with issues of how you control migration and other justice and home affairs issues. That can change the whole basis of what happens. Most important of all, in the area of returns of people who are in the EU illegally to their country of origin. One of the most difficult and unpleasant aspects of government policy, but I believe if you don't deal with the people who are here illegally and it's been decided they have to return to their country of origin, at the end of the day, people will simply assume there'll never be an enforcement of the system that is in place. And unfortunately, enforcement has to happen. Obviously, enforcement in a just way, in a humane way, but unless you say we actually think open borders, completely open borders, at the EU external border, the right thing, which I don't think you can do, then you have to enforce the borders you have. My final point is, it's just a particular UK point, is that I very much hope that the UK will develop a much more coherent approach of working closely with the Schengen countries. The UK faces a set of issues in the next couple of years as to whether it's going to pull out of the Justice and Home Affairs legislation which currently exists. The current government hasn't, the current Conservative government in the UK hasn't been clear on this, but I'm absolutely clear for myself that we would benefit, the UK would benefit from a very close working relationship with Schengen, and we shouldn't do anything to weaken it. In fact, we should strengthen it in a variety of ways, which I set out in my pamphlet. So to summarise, I'm strongly in favour of the vision of Europe that you were setting out, Cecilia, and as I say, I applaud your own efforts in that. I think it is important to work on in the kinds of ways set out in what I think is an excellent council statement that Dimitri has written, to develop societies which are tolerant and positive within the European Union. It has to be dealt with at a local level rather than at an overall EU level, but nevertheless that can be encouraged in a variety of ways. But also, and it's my final point, we have to find ways of governing migration which give the people of the continent confidence that we are actually organising and controlling the situation correctly. And if we fail to do so, we will find increasing disillusion with the European Union as a whole and with the mainstream political parties, which I personally think is also politically dangerous at a wider level, which is why I think we have to give it higher priority, which is why I welcome the MPI's decision to establish itself here in Brussels and bring some of the intellectual muscle which you represent to the debate here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think you set out an ambitious agenda for the EU over the next few years. Quite a lot to see there. And if I can hand over to Patrick Simon, who will offer, I think, some thoughts from a paper that has not yet been published. So it's not within your little package of papers, but is forthcoming from MPI, I think, on the French case and how identity fits with integration policy.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here for this launch, a very impressive contribution of MPI to the European debate. And speaking about identity, I have to take the identity of the social scientist, or maybe it is the role rather than the identity, which is not providing answers but asking questions. So, in the evidence-based policy, I'm the evidence somehow. I try to give some ideas about the debate we have. Most of the European societies have today on national identity. I'm not talking about the European identity as such, which is a very important topic by itself, but about national identity in Europe, which is a different topic. And I would argue that the challenge is merely to update and reframe the national software, to call it this way. That is, to try to bring in the national narrative outsiders, which is the next step. We have discussed so far about migration and how to deal with migration, but we left apart the consequences of migration, the long-lasting consequences in the transformation of societies who used to be, define themselves as very homogeneous society and are becoming increasingly diverse by their composition of the population through migration. So the challenge is not only to acknowledge the fact that most, if not all, European societies are immigration countries, which is more or less this step has been made by most of them, but also to try to see how far do they perceive themselves as diverse society, which is not to say multicultural society, but to say that they are not made by the same historical circumstances that they have created their nation state. And this updating is maybe the reason why there are these conflictual behaviors and discourses about national identity. We'll all agree on the fact that we are facing a rising concern about national identity in all European countries, not only those who do have this strong nationalistic history like France, which is usually talking about nation, but also from countries who used to define themselves in a more multicultural way and less eager to define a nation as a reference for the collective identity, such as UK or Sweden, maybe, or the Netherlands. So there is a convergent trend in trying to reinforce the value of national identity and to focus on the non-compliance of minorities to this national identity, which is a surprise. So far, we try to enforce civic tests for naturalization, which is barely the case for all the European societies, and it is true as well for the US, to try to produce criteria for checking if candidates for naturalization do fit in the new society they're aiming at. But these tests have been expanded to admission for residency as well. So it seems that outsiders, let's call them that, migrants and second generation and third generation, which are perceived as still different from the majority population, are being asked to perform better than the citizens themselves. And that's a striking trend which is going over all European countries. There is two ways to understand this crystallization around the alleged lack of compliance or stickiness of the minorities to the national identity. One thing is try to reduce the differences within the society so far to achieve equality. So that's one type of political philosophy, which is reaching equality through uniformity, which is one strategy that has been fostered by some European countries. So trying to produce convergence of values, norms, and that's what we call assimilation. So that's one of the expectations. And the role of national identity in this case is to try to be an overarching references for producing this uniformity and to create invisibility in the long run. The second one, and I would say basically this is the objectives of an integration policy. Integration policy is trying to reduce differences. And the second one, which is not only exclusive, but really it's a bit different, is trying to incorporate as a non-problematic difference, which is to keep differences visible, but to try to produce equality, to accommodate diversity. And that is the objective of non-discrimination policies. And my guess is that for my take on Europe is that we are facing a conflict between these two lines, which are trying to reduce visibility or to trying to reduce the consequences of visibility, which is not exactly the same objectives. So going back to national identity and my proposal about the challenge to try to update national identity, what is the problem with national identity of the minorities? What kind of information do we have about that? Are we facing especially the rise of a withdrawal from national identity from the minorities? Are we seeing minority members claiming that they don't belong to the society, refusing to adopt specific cultural norms or practices? Or when we do have surveys, do we see a lack of belonging from the minorities? Well, looking at the major social science survey, we don't find that. We find that overall, minorities do have the same level of national belongings than those who are not minorities in the same country. So, why do we have this rise of fear and anxiety on national identity? Well, maybe this fear and anxiety on national identity tells us more about the society itself than the position of the minorities. It is a lack of confidence in the efficiency of these common norms and values, and maybe an anxiety about the evolution of the national identity itself, not only by the activity of the minorities, but also by the transformation of society itself. And Europe is one, European integration is one of the, of course, the process which is reframing the national identities in Europe. So I'm trying to illustrate this issue by the French example, which is one case study, but we will have some findings from the another survey in UK about the citizenship survey in UK, which gave exactly the same kind of outcomes, which is more than 85% of minorities in UK do feel like belonging to the British identity. so through the share of the British identity with the others. So it seems that there are an agreement about that. And we do have somehow the same findings for France, in which migrants and second generation do declare feeling French in a very high level. And I'm looking for the data. But we have added some extra questions in the survey asking, do you think that the others see you as French, which is not how do you feel, but how do you think you look like? And the striking finding that we have is that more than a third than the second generation do say that they are not seen as French. And among this second generation, if you contrast between those who do have a European ancestry, which are the Italians, Spanish, or Portuguese living in France from the parents coming from these countries, with the blacks coming from the sub-Saharan African or the French Caribbeans and the Maghrebians, you have a wide difference between those who say that 5% of the European ancestry second generation do say that they do not feel that the others see them as French, compared to about half of the blacks and the Maghrebians, Arabs, do say that they are not seen as French by the others, regardless of their citizenship, which is French for most of them. So what I'll try to pinpoint here is that the main challenge is not defining yourself by the minorities, it's that the acceptance by the majority that being French or being British or being Swedish is also having an immigrant background, which is redefining the national identity by incorporating the diversity, which is not a recent diversity, which is now more than 40 years diversity, which is supposed to stay for a long time. So this redefinition, revision of the national identity is the main challenge, I guess, to reduce the emergence of this populist and extreme right anti-migration party, which is not only targeting migration as such, but is also targeting those who are not migrants anymore, those who are living in society, part of society, citizens of these societies, but having a different ethnic background, which put them as very special citizens among Europe.
Thank you very much. I think it's a fascinating way of thinking national identity, not a static, but it's something that has to constantly be updated. And last but not least, Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of MPI.
Thank you. I'm grateful to see so many friends in the audience, including some old friends from the United States. This is the culmination of a 10-year effort, more of a back and forth as to whether to actually expand and set anchor, as it were, with a legal presence in Europe. It's an exploration that started, you know, in conversations 10 years ago with Gregory Maniatis that I see there during the Greek presidency. And it's interesting that 10 years later we're finally doing it. So I'm very pleased to have completed this circle, at least. I am terribly grateful to you, Cecilia. You have been always kind and generous with your time with us. You always find time for us when we visit. I think that you have set a new standard on how commissioners in this most difficult of portfolios ought to act, stay in the course, tell them the truth, fight in the good fight, and we wish you the very best, of course. Charles, as you mentioned, is a relatively new member of the Transatlantic Council. You will recognize some of the other members, such as, of course, Antonio Vitorino, Giuliano Amato, Rita Sismuth, Mike Chertoff, the last DHS Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security in the United States, I'm sorry about the acronyms, and a number of others. We're grateful to you, Charles, for always joining us in our events and providing so much value. What I'm going to try to do in the next 10 minutes is, in a very quick way, present some of the results of the last meeting of the Transatlantic Council on Migration, which took place in this remarkable place of the German Bundestag in November of last year. And I was looking at this wonderful banner. It's the first time that I've seen it. Independent, it was certainly a bat. Nonpartisan, I don't think it's terribly relevant in Europe, but we are that. Evidence-driven. For each meeting of the Transatlantic Council, we commission about a dozen papers, 10 to 14 papers. And for those of you who sometimes, on and off, are worried that somehow this is an American institution, you know, trying to promote American positions, etc., etc., no, that's not what it is that we do. We try to focus on policy solutions to migration, and not American immigration or Belgian immigration, but international migration, and how, whether it is the member states of the European Union or other countries around the world, not only do deal with it, but how they perhaps should deal with this. And part of what it is that you will be receiving, I suspect, now that if we have your emails over the next 2 or 3 months, is all of these 12 papers. And you have 3 plus the Council statement. There's only 1 U.S. paper there. There are 2 Canadian papers. Mm-hmm. All of the other ones are European papers. We know what the dominant narrative of the day is. Certainly the Commissioner and Charles have already talked about it. Communities and societies throughout our countries are feeling that they are being transformed at a pace that challenges long and closely held notions of national identity. And this is, of course, the murkiest of topics on international migration. It's not really about, mostly about some sort of a prescription of what to do about it, but a series of things of what not to do, perhaps, even more than the things that you should do. And the reasons for that vary across countries. Certainly one of the reasons that is common, that is shared among countries, is that so many of our countries, almost all of our countries, are finding themselves in the midst of enormous economic uncertainty. And that certainly colors the way that people experience what they think are the effects of immigration and, of course, globalization, because globalization is the other likely culprit, as it were, as to why change is taking place at a pace that people don't quite understand, and something that we really can't do much about. And of course, depending on the country, politicians are focusing on different reasons, different explanations for it. Some of them are talking about too much immigration. Some of them, in the United States, they're talking about too much illegal immigration. Some politicians have chosen to take on multiculturalism, you know. There have always been sotto voce complaints about multiculturalism, but the frontal attack on it by major leaders in Europe and elsewhere have become rather, you know, loud in the past year and a half. Not necessarily taking on multiculturalism itself, the concept, but primarily on what they think that multiculturalism has done, namely that multiculturalism, by focusing on difference, has actually contributed to societies coming a bit more apart than they ought to be otherwise. And of course, in practically every place, there is a sense among some, in some instances among many, that integration is failing. And, you know, not, you know, there's no such thing as a real definition of what integration is. I don't think that, you know, people really feel that they have to parse out and figure out what part of integration is really failing in their countries, but there is a sense that we're losing the game. The game here being the game of weaving stronger and stronger the societal fabric, what makes us, you know, the countries that we are. And somehow, you know, this fabric is coming apart, and the policies that we have in place, including, as Charles mentioned, in the United States, or maybe it was you, Cecilia, the lack of policies, somehow are no longer working. I will tell you that, you know, if you really look at integration outcomes, the evidence is mixed. There are some failures, there are also some extraordinary successes. So what this council statement that we have here is trying to do is summarize what it is that we discussed in Berlin, and come up with a number of pithy statements about what to do and what not to do. And it will also discuss the five principal drivers of anxiety. I think that both the commissioner and Charles and Patrick have already addressed all of them, so I'm not going to say anything about them. So those 10 principles or conclusions that the council reached are things that you will understand, things that perhaps you will say, ah, yeah, I get this. But that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to really do the last thing here on this particular chart, which is policy focused. We're trying to pull out of the discussions what we think is a particular value. The first one, and we put it first on purpose, because we think that it is important. Cecilia hit it exactly in between the eyes, as it were. That leaders must listen to and demonstrate that they understand the concerns of their electorate. There is the listening skills of far too many political leaders in far too many countries for most of the time are severely lacking. And just as Cecilia said, it's not only ignoring what it is that the publics are trying to convey to them. More importantly, is somehow dismissing them. Now, it doesn't mean that the public, you know, that everyone in the public and their complaints or whatever it is have a basis in reality or anything else. But it does mean that if you have well-honed listening skills, you will find something that you can actually address. As a political leader, as a governmental leader, there are some things that you can do that can actually create a better environment in which you can actually continue to pursue immigration policy for the reasons that everyone in this room knows. Immigration is here, it's a fact of life, it's likely to be at least as much, possibly more immigration in the future if you don't know how to get it right. The electorates will deny you the right to actually be able to open up when you need to open up. Failure today guarantees much larger failure tomorrow. The second one is building a sense of ownership in the integration process. It's entirely possible that as governments, particularly in Europe, that engage on explicit integration policy, may not always have an ongoing conversation with their publics, not to ask them what to do or what not to do, but to engage them in the integration process. As Cecilia said, integration happens on the ground. It's in our cities, in boroughs, whatever it is that the proper word is in Europe. In the United States, it is in counties and in cities. That's where it happens, that's where experimentation happens, that's where good ideas and bad ideas actually play themselves out. Somebody ought to actually be working with civil society at all times to engage them in shaping better policies in the future, learning from mistakes, You know, we all are so fearful of failure, and we forget that we learn most from failure. I think, you know, and I know that this may sound ridiculous, but we need to embrace failure, learn from it, and move on. The third one, and Charles, I think, may have mentioned this, or was, I'm sorry, I apologize, I no longer mention, I will no longer mention who said what. Finally, and I've been arguing this point, and council has been arguing this point for decades now, national identity now in Europe and elsewhere is seen properly. That is, that national identity is more about becoming rather than being. Traditional countries of immigration, because they don't have that weight of history, have always seen, you know, the sense of a national identity as something that continuously shifts. It's something that's always dynamic. But all too many places, you know, with deep histories, tend to think of national identity as static. We have to really understand that it's about the process itself, the constantly becoming, shifting, engaging, embracing, stopping what needs to be stopped, etc. The fourth point was that already done extremely well by the panel. Multiple identities. Can we stop having a conversation about multiple identities? I mean, everybody gets it. You know, why do some governments decide to take on the idea of multiple identities, trying to deny this or deny that? It doesn't make any sense. In the November discussion, and this is the point that I will make later, Charles spoke about what government should do and the kinds of things that government should stay out of. And I think trying to define identity is easily something that the government should stay out of the business of. A point that was already made, create clear pathways to permanent residence and citizenship. Get people involved. Let them understand and realize and embrace the simple idea that the community belongs to all of them, to all of us, I should say. When we work together, we can build more successful communities. It's a no-brainer, but all too often, you know, people are moving in different ways. And I must say, you know, over the past few years, most countries are moving in the right direction of this. You know, after so many fits and starts and problems, et cetera, in Germany, for instance, until a few years ago, now, in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, that lesson has been learned. This way we move very clearly on how you gain permanent residence, what the requirements are for citizenship, and most importantly, how to deliver these outcomes in a transparent way that leads to predictable outcomes. In other words, you, meaning someone who is trying to get citizenship, knows at each point in the process what he or she needs to do, and if they do that, the end result should be automatic. The next one, offer practical, non-punitive integration assistance. All too often, smart integration ideas get colored by a sense that there is a punitive component to it, that somehow governments are putting these requirements there not for the reasons that they express, namely in order to create a civic identity, in order to develop, you know, a common language without denying the language of origin, et cetera, but somehow in a very punitive way or threatening way. You either do this or what? That's what I object to. Or what? What government is going to somehow remove somebody for having failed, you know, to pass the civic test? Yeah, they can deny him or her citizenship, but will they remove them? So, if you're going to be implicitly, at least, threatening something, well, should you in the first place? And second, the seventh, focusing integration efforts on the places where integration takes place. It's something that again has been mentioned here. Integration takes place most naturally in two places, the workplace and schools. So let's focus, let's work with all of the social actors, and let's focus our attention and resources in these two areas where we can actually make the greatest degree of difference. We're already investing significant resources in all of this. How about if we were to invest them more smartly? The eighth point, focus on all disadvantaged populations, not just immigrants. It's a conversation that is raging, you know, here beginning to rage in the Netherlands and other places about mainstreaming, etc., etc. This is not an answerable proposition. The logic of this is that if you focus on the conditions on the ground, let's say you want to reduce poverty, to bring about greater language coherence or do something else, and if you focus on that, inevitably you will capture the populations that need that. And among these populations, you will capture immigrant populations. So if you need to do this because focusing explicitly on immigrants is toxic for a period of time, politically speaking, do this. But do it smartly. This way you are attacking the conditions. The ninth recommendation is, or conclusions, about legislating cultural practices. Those should be a last resort rather than a first impulse. We know of a couple of countries that politically at least they try to do this as a first impulse, whether it is, you know, occasionally on and off what France is trying to do, or the Swiss trying to regulate minarets and things like that. There's some things, you know, that government should stay out. I said that. The final thing is that we, the government leader, the governments, leaders, political leaders, civil society leaders, have to be very careful about the tone that they adopt with regard to immigration. And here, sometimes actions speak more loudly than words. So it's not only the political language that we have to mind, but it is something that I call the body language of a government. People actually respond and understand the latter much better than they understand and respond to the former. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think it reflects one of the most interesting meetings I think we've ever had of the Transatlantic Council, and particularly one of the most difficult issues. And with that, I'd like to open the floor for questions. We have about, well, let's say, if you can hold off from the wine for 15 minutes, let's say we have half an hour for questions. Does anyone have any questions for the panel, or perhaps comments on what they've heard, discussion? Heather, just up there. Melissa, you have a question?
I have a short question anyway, so by the time the microphone comes, it'll be done. Many of these policy issues have been with us for many years, for decades here in Europe. What seems to be new is the politics. Are we seeing the politics of migration becoming toxic in an irrevocable way? Can we go back to the progressive times that brought us everything from the Race Equality Directive to moves towards greater common policy on migration at EU level, or are we really facing now a long slide into more and more difficult waters politically?
And can I ask if there are any other questions? Let's gather two or three and then put them together. Justin?
John Wilde. More than 20 years ago, when I was a correspondent in Italy, I remember in response to the flow of migrants across the Adriatic from Albania, the government suddenly got up one morning and announced that they were in future going to assess employment needs well in advance, and every year plan an immigrant flow according to both numbers and also professional qualifications. Entirely logical, is it actually possible, and is it desirable, in fact, to have such a sophisticated, it seems to me, planned immigration policy? And of course, the question is particularly relevant at a time of economic difficulty and recession, where again it seems to me that the edge of host population concern about immigration at the moment is about job security and job replacement.
Just here at the front. If you could introduce yourself, that would be great.
Yeah, my name is Clara Healy from ICMPD in Vienna. It was a very interesting discussion, and I'm really glad that finally the focus has shifted to national policies and national identity. And for a long time now, for maybe 12 years, we've been talking about the two-way nature of integration, but I think this is the first time we've really looked at the other side. So I think it's interesting, but I, for one, am extremely anxious about European values and what migration does to European values. Not because I have a fear, I'm not one of the people that do exist in Europe who have a fear of what migration can bring in terms of changing our values. I have a fear of what migration has done to some of my fellow European citizens and to the growth of these political parties. And I think this is the same continent where we had an economic recession in the 1930s and we had a swing to the right. And I think we need to be extremely careful about what happens to those very European values that we talk about protecting, and that some of the debate sometimes centres around, you know, these non-European cultures and how they may not understand our values. Well, I think it's us ourselves, you know, who are not understanding our values, and I think that's the challenge that migration has brought, and that's where we need to protect our values. So I'd be interested to hear comments, because I think a lot of the speakers very much touched on these issues.
Thank you. I think we'll just take those three and then a second round. To recap for those at the back who might not have heard, a discussion about whether the current state of the debate, the toxicity of the immigration debate will stay this way. Is it irrevocable? Is it possible to plan migration policy and see it through? And how careful do we need to be about our own European values and the role of immigration plays within that? If I can go from in speaking order, or if anyone has anything particularly useful to say, but let's go in speaking order.
Thank you. Are we facing new times? Herbert asked. Well, I don't really know. That's for the future to tell. But I said in my introduction that we have, since the Second World War, we never had so many elected anti-migration parties in national and local parliaments as we have today. I think that this is a sign, and it coincides with probably the biggest economic crisis in the last century. And I think it has a link, these two. And people are having extremely tough times in Europe. People are losing their jobs. They are fear for the future. They don't know if they can afford their children's education, if they can stay in their home. They have whole cities closing down because dependence on certain factories and so on. Of course, this creates a lot of anxiety. And in these times, it's always easy to look for scapegoats, and some are quick to use these. And one of these scapegoats are migration or whatever you want to call it. And this is extremely dangerous, because not only these more extremist parties that are roughly quite small in most countries, but when ordinary parties try to adopt to their agenda, because people, my voters, cannot accept this, and classical centre-right or centre-left or centre parties are adopting to the same agenda, this sort of rhetoric becomes acceptable. It becomes normal. And that is very dangerous. So that's why we need to look up, and that's why we need to challenge the rhetoric, we need to challenge the easy solutions, but of course, as everybody has agreed, recognize the anxieties and the worries that people have in these difficult times. And that's where values also are being threatened, of course. And I think they are being threatened not only because of migration, but because many people feel their whole life falling apart. And the economic crisis is really, really touching many people who were maybe living on the margins before and who are now the first to fall victims of this. We should not forget that migration, many migrants who come to Europe as asylum seekers, they come to Europe because the values they promote, they cannot defend in their countries. They run away from a dictatorship or an oppressive regime who do not allow them freedom of speech, freedom of expression, their possibilities to choose their lives. So they do share our values, a vast majority. So I do not think that migration shares a value. But that said, we need to be crystal clear. You mentioned that the state should not mess with cultural values. No, but it also says that some issues we need to be crystal clear. Genital mutilation is not accepted. Honorary killings are not accepted. Women and men are equal. You do not marry your 12-year-old girl to someone. I mean, certain of these things we need to be crystal clear. It's not making favorites to welcoming different cultures. These things are not negotiable. And you say so very clearly in your paper as well. So I think we should be clear on these values. But otherwise, values are probably not threatened in that, but in the general sort of unrest that people live in today. On quotas, well, I don't think you can plan exactly quotas, but definitely we know that there will be a lack of people in certain fields. We can prognose some of them more or less correctly. And we should definitely, on a European level, facilitate for people to come, to get rid of the red tape, that every country will have to choose where do they need these people, how many, if any, in what fields, and so on. So that cannot be imposed on a European level, but we could facilitate for people. If you have a job, you can come. And this is a very short formula you have to fill in. In general, there will be a great need of IT technicians, there will be a great need of healthcare workers, there will be engineers are missing desperately in some countries like Germany today, and you can prognose it, and OECD have a lot of different statistics. But to do exact quotas on labour migration, you could probably make prognosis, but I don't think it's possible. You could also make certain quotas on resettlement, on asylum, but certainly it depends very much on what happens in the world. So that is also very difficult to plan for. Now I'll leave. Everybody has that much to say on this. Sorry, it's been so long.
You weren't long. I've got two answers. Firstly, to Heather's point, I'm a deep optimist about this. I think our society will move forward. I feel more confident about it than I have been. But what it requires is for political leaders, social leaders, media, a whole range of different people to speak with confidence about these questions. And for various reasons, we haven't spoken with that confidence. And so have tended to go to the lowest common denominator of populism or nationalism or whatever, in a very unsuccessful way. It's about being able to talk properly about what our values are, about the kinds of issues that Cecilia just said. I chair a set of debates which is taking place in London at the moment, which is the end of 5 years of research on the place of religion and society in the UK, a £12 million research programme, a good set of events, and we were doing education last week, a couple of weeks before that, identity, really high quality discussions. And what comes out of it is that there is not a confidence, even amongst the informed people, about how you talk about the place of religion in our society. What is the place of religion in our society? I'm talking about the UK, not more widely. But I think these values questions on the cultural issues, there isn't a confidence as to how to speak. So what we have to do, and that's why I think the think tanks are very important, actually, is to begin to develop a much better understanding and confidence about how we talk about those things and to encourage people to talk about those things. But at the bottom line, I'm fundamentally an optimist rather than a pessimist, because I think there's been a tendency to sweep all this under the carpet. It's no longer there. When it's there being thought about, I think people will address those questions rather than not. On the economic question that Tom raised, I argue in my piece that really developing the European labour market is absolutely central. There are millions of people, tens of millions of people in Europe, who are not able, for a variety of reasons, to get access to the kinds of jobs that Cecilia was just describing. Is that because they're fundamentally incapable of doing it, or is it because our education, training, integration, cohesion policies are not succeeding? Certainly in Britain, there's a lot of evidence that those people who are most exercised about migration are exactly the same people who are not, young people who are not getting work in key areas, actually not getting work because they haven't got the qualifications and capacity to do it, and they are blaming the migrants for, quote, taking their jobs, unquote. But in fact, the migrants aren't, quote, taking their jobs. The migrants are doing jobs that otherwise would be undone. So the policy challenge is how to ensure that every young person in Britain really has the possibility of doing jobs in this kind. And I think that arises right through the EU. I'm not a fan of the Lisbon programme, the economic Lisbon programme, which I don't think has really succeeded in these areas. And were I in the leadership of the European Union, I'd really be examining carefully what that programme did or didn't do. Of course, as Cecilia says, it's now been exacerbated by the post-2008 situation, the crisis in the Eurozone, which makes that all far more difficult. But I don't really think we've got coherent policies about jobs, education, training for young people throughout the European Union. And so if key pieces of work are not being, can't be done by millions of people who live in the EU, obviously we'll look to migrants to do those. But actually the first stop should be to say, well, can we achieve a situation where every young person growing up in the EU has a real chance of getting a worthwhile job, education for them? And that remains, I would say, a really major challenge. There are significant sections of the excluded population, and that's where the power of Dimitri's, I can't remember what it was, Dimitri, I think it's your about eighth point, that it's not simply that these issues are issues, these issues are issues for the whole community, not just for the ethnic minority communities. There are a whole chunk of people who simply feel they're excluded from society. The Labour government had an approach called the social to fight social exclusion, which was successful in one or two areas, but we found it very, very difficult, in truth, to really get policies which tackled this issue that whole chunks of people felt excluded from the society. And finding a way through that remains, I would say, the central priority in the whole labour market issues.
No, not so much to add to these very important statements. I guess what is striking in the recent evolution of in migration policies is the link between migration and integration, which is not only considering the needs, demographic or economic needs for migration, but also anticipating the consequences of migration and training to select migrants not only by their skills, but also by their alleged matching with the cultural and values dimension of society, the receiving society. So the idea that we should reduce the dissonance between the migrants and the society they will live in, so that to make sure that this society will remain unchanged. It's a way to reduce the evolution of these societies, going back to the to what Dimitri has said. And that's it is a striking evolution. And I think this anticipation and this anxiety about the change that would be brought by migration is something that goes in line with what has been said about the fundamental values. It's not to say that we should be less firm on these fundamental values about equality and women's rights, for example, but to take care about the thin line between promoting these values and going further to try to emphasize the lack of democratic values, for example, for some groups, or the lack of skills in living together from some others, and in this slippery slope to end by defining those who are adapted to live in democratic societies and those who are not. And part of the debate on migration these days is on identities is trying to create a clash of visions of the world and lifestyles among those who are living in European societies. And building it on migration without directly saying that those who are candidate for migration, in fact, already a part of them already live in the societies. So the discourse about the potential migrants is addressing clearly minorities within and not those who are living abroad. And that's the tension which is created by this conception of clashes, I think, is one of the major problems that should be addressed by political leaders.
Right. So I want to say something. I see Jean-Louis Debray over there. Welcome, Jean-Louis. because he embodies all of the history of all of these issues in a single person. And he's shaking his head. And a very thin body, yes, as our commissioner says. I think it's thin because of the portfolio. But on the question about, you know, sort of whatever it is that the Italian politicians may have promised or not 20 years ago, this is a very difficult issue, you know. The idea that somehow you can match person by person or that the government can do that is for the birds, as we say in the United States. Labor matching, however, can happen in a different way. For instance, the Swedes, I think, have innovated, you know, certainly the way that everybody is moving across the ocean and here, which is let the system be as much employer-driven as the system can accommodate. In other words, if you have to think through these issues, decide what the parameters are within which employers can operate, and then allow the employers to actually do the actual matching. They know what jobs they have. There is no government agency that says in 3 months from now, you know, we're going to need 13 and a half plumbers. Now, clearly there are some occupations, the commission already mentioned, we all know healthcare, I mean everything from home care to, you know, to emergency room nurses are needed. So that's an easy one, you know. This one you can say, okay, you know, let's develop the standards. And people who meet those, you know, can try, can have hospitals, you know, et cetera, playing this. And so the matching can take place. Clearly, you know, the government should step back rather than being in the center of this. And I think, you know, the commission needs to create the conditions for this to happen and encourage it. And I think we can be there. On the point that Charles mentioned, you know, if it couldn't, I don't know why politicians will not listen to this. Every good thing has winners and losers. It can be globalization, it can be migration. If you don't know how to address the losers, you will not be able to actually create more winners. That's what this comes out to. So focusing, and that's why, you know, it's a wonderful thing that, you know, the commissioner is doing with Commissioner Anders and has this close relationship, crosswalk, we might call crosswalking between DG Home and DG Employment Social Affairs, to actually think together about some of those issues, because it is extremely important that these issues be thought together. And the last comment is on this, you know, the extremist parties, whatever you want to call them. You know, in classic political science literature about political parties, and, you know, I'm not going to be theoretical here because we all understand that, there are a number of things that you can do when you have pressure from the right, or for that matter, pressure from the extreme left. One of them is to deny, isolate, and hoping that they're going to stay at 1 or 2%, okay? As the Germans do, declare them illegal periodically, you know, and try to move on. But most frequently, what the party adjacent to this extremist party will do is adopt some of the agenda in order to deny them political breathing room, as it were. That is a dangerous sport. Okay? It happens all the time. It requires extremely big mind to try to figure out where the lines are, what you deny, what you accept. And, you know, nobody really does it very well. But what concerns me more is, even in a place like Sweden, I'm sorry, I'm not picking on your country, where you have a tiny extreme right or whatever it is, anti-immigrant, anti-Europe, anti-this, anti-that group, inevitably it affects the way that the government governs. Maybe by 1%, maybe. In other words, you always look behind your shoulder, over your shoulder, to see, you know, what is it, you know, will, if I do X, will that create, you know, more of a base for the other ones? And let alone, of course, the Dutch example, where you have a party that's not in the government that basically dictates the terms in which the government behaves on these issues. So these are all dangerous things. I have no idea when they're going to stop, if they're going to stop. or any of those things. My crystal ball broke on the plane often.
So if we can take a second round of questions. I see 1, 2, 3, 4. Mutes are just there, Kadri.
Hi. My name is Kadri Sola from FICOM. I just wanted to throw it out there. Is there any room for a shift in debate concerning irregular migration and irregular migrants specifically on EU level or national level to shift the debate from punitive to rights-based one? To look at access to basic services and fundamental rights. Is there a possibility in the near future for a shift in such a debate? Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. And then the other
chief. One of the earlier questioners said that the issues were the same as they had been for a long time, but it's interesting for me to see that some of the discussions has moved on, in particular with respect to identity, how you identify yourself, and the new discussions about national identity. But I think there's a danger here. I think it's absolutely true one has to rethink national identity and see it as something which is a changing issue. It's not something that's fixed, and it's not very well, it's not clear in European countries what national identity really means. But I think we need also to reinforce the notion of European identity, of European citizenship. I certainly find it very uncomfortable these days because I have to identify as a British citizen. I don't feel very British, and I'm certainly not a citizen of the United Kingdom. I think take some of these 10 points in the Council statement and use those as a basis for trying to develop this question of European identity, particularly looking at things like European history. It always horrifies me that history is so badly taught these days, and if it is taught, it tends to be just history of the 20th century, which is not the right sort of European history to teach, and to restrict it to that. If you do look at a long stretch of European history, it throws the notion of national identity into the air in any case, and I think that's important for people to understand. So more European identity, more European citizenship, I think is important.
Thank you. Can we go to 2 more questions?
First of all, thank you for this great event. My question relates to point 10 in the Council statement, which says states should set the tone about immigration, both through measured political language and body language. And I think a point that's often missing is the role of the media, and I would be interested what the panel thinks what the potential of the media is to help change maybe the national narratives or the narratives in general. And media is often a place where these identities are proliferated or constructed even. And I would be interested on the takes on the role of the media and the potential to drive forward the debate there.
And then Hugo.
Thanks very much. Just a brief comment and 2 questions. First, I want to say that the reason why immigration panics are so scary is that they always seem like this is the very first time it happened. But of course, they've been happening right throughout history. A very little known Shakespeare play is called Thomas More. And at the beginning, I think he was one of your predecessors for a while, Charles. At the beginning of the play, he basically has to go down and deal with a riot over immigrants from Flanders. And he has to try and calm the crowd down. So it was happening in the 1500s. It's been happening. And in fact, anti-immigration is more the orthodoxy, rather than pro-immigration. We should suddenly be shocked when there's a few anti-immigration MPs in Sweden. So, equally it took 60, 70 years for an Irishman to be able to be a credible candidate for US president, but it did happen. And when the Irish arrived in Boston and New York, the nativist illegal immigration parties, perhaps the Hurt Builders of their time, did indeed sprout up and oppose them, often violently. So I think we're a little bit easily shocked. We Europeans, we're not made of glass. Our values are not made of glass. I think what a lot of this debate reflects is our current lack of self-confidence, maybe, in a lot of areas, not just this one. But I'm sure we'll move on from that. So my questions are, number one, as regards political participation, I mentioned an Irishman running for president. What are there any lessons, possibly from the Council's conclusions, about getting immigrants into the political system? And that beginning of sort of, we use this system at first for ourselves, perhaps even ethnically based like the Irish did, but then you move on, you get taken into the system, et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything interesting to say at a European level about the political participation amongst newly arrived immigrants, second generation, whatever. And the other point is that when I speak to officials here in Brussels or maybe from Stockholm or Paris, they talk about areas, neighbourhoods that we've lost. So neighbourhoods, ghettos, where effectively they've dropped out of the municipal loop. They're no longer being governed the way that a lot of the rest of the country is. What are the first steps? I mean, the panel discussion mentioned education and the workplace, that's basically it. But what's our first step in taking back neighbourhoods or restoring neighbourhoods that are supposedly lost?
Thank you. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to call on people for certain questions, and you might guess which ones you can be called on for. So in terms of shifting the debate on irregular migration, can I ask Charles if you have any comments on that based on your experience in the UK?
I simply think there's a dislocate between two communities. The intelligentsia, the opinion-forming community, the think tank community are focused on the rights issues, quite rightly, because there are major rights issues that need to be addressed and talked about. On the other hand, many, many sections of the population are focused on the, not necessarily punitive, I wouldn't think it's punitive, it's more a sense of needing self-protection from people who are coming to the country who they think are challenging their rights to be there. And it's a simple lack of communication. Now, as Home Secretary, one of my responsibilities was to deal with those kinds of issues. I hope I tried to do it in a way which took account of both strands. But you just have to take account of both. And so when you're talking about asylum, it's perfectly reasonable at the same time to say that asylum seekers should be treated in accord with the law, fairly, reasonably, justly, as their claim is being considered. And at the same time to say that the claim has to be considered quickly, and once resolved, the decision has to be implemented. I don't myself see a contradiction between those two things. And I think that what is really important is to do things properly and correctly in this process. And that's why I emphasise all the time this question of governance, because I think unless you look at the governance of migration, you end up with very unpleasant and, in a sense, false conflicts going on between people worried about rights on the one hand and what you call punitive actions on the other. And I don't myself think there's a contradiction between them in reality. I think there's a contradiction in the fact that they're not both part of the same political discourse.
Thank you. And if I can ask Patrick the question, do you think European identity is a way out of the fluctuating national identity and this sort of clash of approaches? And if so, does it, you know, how would you define that for the French national identity?
Well, that's a difficult question. It seems that a European identity is not really an appealing identity for most of the European population. I would say all the surveys done that are clear, saying that it's not yet a reference. Even though it's growing identification, it's not replacing national identity. It could be for minority one intermediate or superior supranational identity to go directly to the European identity. It may happen in some time, but it's not really a way to try to reduce the importance or the danger behind national identity. I think it's not that. But I think the question of history is a very important one, and what we are not totally clear about is it has already happened somehow, not exactly in the same term, not exactly in the same context, and specifically not before the creation of the nation states in the 19th and 20th century. So I think comparing migration before the creation of nations, the modern nation states, and after, it's not exactly the same dynamic. So maybe the first time we have it, and secondly, the first time that we do have massive migration from non-European countries, which is not only to say that it's a distant or a different cultural background, it's mainly to say that it comes from societies that have been dominated by Europe, European powers through time, created as inferior by the representation, by colonization. And so now we have to face a new step in history in which there is the empire strikes back somehow. And it has consequences, which is not the same comparing Polish migrants in France and in Germany and Algerian migrants in France or Pakistani migrants in UK. I think it's not the same tension, the same history behind, and maybe it hurts more national identity in this specific dimension of post-colonial migration than it does when it comes from a different type of migration.
Thank you. And Dimitri, if the body language of governments is desperately important, then what is the role of the media? Is it the jazz hands of the body language of government, or is it a separate institution that needs to be checked?
Well,
if you can get the Return of the Jedi into this answer, you get extra points, by the way.
I was hoping that the commissioner was going to have the last word. She still will have the last word, right? Good. I am, you know, there are an awful lot of smart people who have invested an awful lot of money in trying to influence and help the media develop a narrative that is a narrative that makes sense, that is fair, that is progressive, that looks to the future, etc., etc. My experience in how many decades, I do not want to say, with trying to shape, you know, coverage by media in the United States, so I cannot speak about Europe, is that by and large it's a lost cause. Okay? It doesn't mean that it cannot be done, but because, you know, the best papers typically, you know, change their reporters on this issue every 3 years. And because there's a big difference between the editorial pages in American newspapers and the actual reportage, you know, what you have is essentially often a discontinuity. Take the New York Times, you know, by most accounts, perhaps all accounts, the most important newspaper in the United States. It has a decidedly ultra-progressive editorial page when it comes to immigration. It does not sway a single person. I have yet to find someone up on the Hill, I'm sorry, in, you know, in the U.S. Congress or, you know, in the corridors of power saying, you know what, the New York Times said that we should do that, you know, we should consider it. And the same million people who read the New York Times read the New York Times. In other words, preaching to the converted is really what happens. Now, again, there are people who specialize on this, people who are doing now sort of super intelligent psychologists that actually have tried to figure out, you know, how the mind works, how messaging takes place, etc., etc., who will probably disagree with what I said. But from my perspective, it's become one, it is one of the most difficult areas to actually influence.
And finally, Commissioner, if we can turn to the last question, I'm struck by what Hugo said, which is values are not made of glass, and yet we often treat them as universal and never changing. And also, in terms of intergenerational values, they might change between the values of someone in their 60s or 70s and the values of someone in adolescence coming up throughout the world. And so how do we think about values in a concrete way, which is some of these ways that Hugo is outlining, which is how do we think about participation in politics? How do we think about lost neighbourhoods when we talk about the universal values and getting those into practice? How do you make that link between the rhetoric of values and the practice? Sorry, you get the hard question, I'm afraid.
Difficult, that question is, as Yoda said. Yeah, how many hours do I have?
Oh, you get points for that, it's fine.
No, I agree with Yoga, we shouldn't panic, but also we should not neglect what is happening. I mean, we do have strong xenophobic parties close to power in many countries today, and they do direct the agenda. Of course, this is nothing new, but they are there, and they are growing, so we should be aware. Well, there is not one single recipe for this. Of course, there's neighborhoods in the city I live in Gothenburg, where 77% of the adults have no job. And they are mainly people from other origin than Swedish living there. They are children who don't know anybody except this teacher who has a job. And of course, jobs is crucial. Schools are crucial. The whole living standard is crucial because they seem to have really grouped lots of people in areas that were built in very short time in the 70s, and they're not really nice to live in, and they've been neglected and so on. Of course, that does not create a good environment. Language is key. The whole infrastructure in the area is very important, and the possibility to participate. Of course, if you are a third generation migrant in a country and you can still not vote, how can you influence your situation on a local level? So that is important. The possibilities to really influence, the possibility, someone said, to be elected, to be representative, to be even a local politician or a leader of the national, the local little club, whatever it is, that is important. There is no easy recipes, but we need. It's extremely important that the local politicians do not disregard this and start to act, and starting with their children and in school. Because otherwise some of these areas, and we've seen them in Europe, become very explosive. And that is, of course, a very bad ground for integration. It also creates ammunition to those who are against this, even if people have been living there for generations. So I don't have an easy solution to this, but it needs special care, special policies, and a lot of attention, and starting with the child.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank all our panellists. I've seen it quite a pot in here, so I would like to thank Commissioner Malmstrom, Charles Clark, Patrick Simon for coming all this way to and spend their time with us today.
For more information about MPI Europe, please visit www.mprEurope.org.